America's Cannabis Conversation.
Good afternoon and welcome to America's Cannabis Conversation. I'm Mark Corsi, CEO and co-founder of the W420 Radio Network. We would like to thank our audience for making our premier show an amazing success. Our team has spent months creating a program that is dedicated to education, challenge, and promoting a healthy and lively dialogue regarding all things cannabis. Each Saturday at 4:20, our host, Dan Perkins, will lead the conversation and introduce you to a wide variety of guests and engage in thought-provoking discussions on topics from tips on growing to what's next in legalization. We are proud to continue October commercial-free, so sit back and enjoy America's Cannabis Conversation. And thank you for tuning in. And now, let's start the conversation.
Welcome to America's Cannabis Conversation. Heard every Saturday at 4:20 p.m. online at americascannabisconversation.com. Each week, we provide our listeners information, education, and insight into the exploding medical and adult-use cannabis industry. You'll hear from industry experts, elected officials, local growers, detractors, and more. Learn how to build your own cannabis business, how to grow the product, what's legal, and where it's legal. Tune in each week to hear the latest industry news and updates from the American Cannabis Industry Association in Washington, tips on investing in cannabis, personal success stories, and more. It's time to join the conversation. And here's your host, Dan Perkins.
This is Dan Perkins with your 2.5 minutes of cannabis quick news. Let's go to San Diego, California. San Diego is expected to crack down by year's end on billboards advertising marijuana, a move supported by much of the cannabis industry. The proposed rule would ban cannabis billboard ads within 1,000 feet of schools, public parks, playgrounds, daycare centers, and youth centers in San Diego. The restrictions would apply to both legal and illegal marijuana businesses, a move applauded by the local cannabis industry. The proposal by Councilman Chris Cate will be heard by the Planning Commission October the 24th and is expected to be approved by the entire City Council before the end of 2019. Moving to the nation's capital, nearly 800 cannabis business leaders and policy experts led by the National Cannabis Industry Association are calling on Congress to remove marijuana from the Federal Controlled Substance Act as the vaping crisis continues. The recent illnesses are unmistakable reminders of the importance of effective regulation, the letter to the congressional leadership said. It is confirmed that Americans are being hurt because of unregulated, illicit market of cannabis vape products. It is yet another reason for real, comprehensive federal cannabis reform that will allow regulated, tested cannabis industry to displace the illicit market actors. Now, Las Vegas. Nevada's first cannabis tasting room is opening this weekend, giving the venue a head start on a sector that won't be widely available for 2 years. The Las Vegas Paiute Tribe will open the establishment Saturday at the New View Cannabis Marketplace, which is located on tribal land about 2 blocks from downtown Las Vegas. In June, the Nevada Governor Steve Schlock, a Democrat, signed a bill that prohibits local governments from licensing marijuana social consumption businesses until 2021. However, New View is on the site of the Las Vegas Paiute Tribe, not a state government. This has been your cannabis quick 2.5 minutes of news. If you want to sign up to get news flashes when they occur, go to W420RadioNetwork.com and sign to become a news insider with instant news sent to your cell phone or your computer at a moment's notice. Today on our program, we'll have two special guests. One is a Harvard Medical School graduate doctor who treats veterans suffering from PTSD and sleep deprivation with cannabis. And the other one is a military veteran who was discharged from the Navy as an opioid addict and was introduced to cannabis, and in 2 years, he completely weaned himself off of opioids in less than 24 months and uses cannabis to deal with his pain. This is Dan Perkins.
Good afternoon. It's 4:20 on Saturday, and this is America's Cannabis Conversation. Today, we have a wonderful guest who's going to talk about you, the listener, and the potential user of this magnificent and interesting product. We've been talking about growers, we've been talking about dispensaries, we've been talking about trimmers and Now we're going to talk about the patients, the people who actually buy the cannabis. And with us today is Harvard-educated and Harvard Medical School graduate, Dr. Jordan Tischler. Dr. Jordan is from Boston. He has his own practice, and we'll talk about what he does in his practice in a moment. But he's, as I said, he's Harvard-educated, done a lot of work at Brigham and Women's and other facilities. And he just has a wealth of knowledge and a lot of experience dealing with cannabis as an alternative therapy to treat certain things. Not everything, but certain things. So, doctor, you were an emergency room specialist and an internist. How did you get involved with cannabis?
Well, as you mentioned, I worked for the VA health system for about 15 years as an emergency room doctor. And through that process, got to see an awful lot of individuals whose lives were really harmed by various substances, alcohol being the number one, and you know, became an expert in substance abuse sort of by trial by fire. And in about 2011, when Massachusetts started talking about cannabis as a potential medicine, I sort of had one of those aha moments where I said, you know, I've never seen anybody who's actually sick from cannabis. So if I've seen all these thousands and thousands of people sick from other things and this hasn't shown up, maybe I should like explore this a little bit and see whether I think that there's any validity to it. So that started me on a sort of, you know, skeptically oriented journey of reading the actual literature. Of course, everyone says, oh, there's no literature. No, there's about 30,000 studies on cannabis. And I, you know, over a period of a few years, came to the conclusion that you alluded to, which is that cannabis is a very reasonable and effective medication if it's used properly and for the proper things.
So we have a doctor who has an epiphany, who begins to educate himself. He's already highly educated from Harvard, but decides that there's something going on here that he needs to research, and you spend the time to research it. But as I recall in our preview conversation, you were not terribly supported in your research and your findings, at least initially.
Well, I think that everybody is a little bit, or at least was, I think that time hopefully has passed, you know, skeptical of whether cannabis provided a real medical resource or whether this was, you know, as you may have heard, some sort of a ploy for stoners to get stoned. And I certainly think that many physicians start from the point of view that they don't want to be sort of the arbiter of somebody's recreational activities. And I think that that's, you know, it's an understandable starting point, but it isn't an understandable ending point now that we have, you know, so not only a very deep and vast literature of its benefits, but also a number of consensus statements, which are panels of intelligent, educated people who have reviewed this literature and come to the conclusion that, you know, that there are medical value here. And certainly the largest or most well-known of those is the National Academy of Science, Engineering, and Medicine, who in January of 2017, so it's already a few years back, published a consensus report that, amongst other things, stated explicitly that there was incontrovertible evidence that cannabis was effective as a pain measure. And at that point, we finally had a government body saying, look, this is real. We have enough information. We should be doing something with this. They also outlined a whole bunch of other fields or areas where the evidence needs to be expanded. But here we have something that says clearly there is medical use. And aside from informing other physicians through that vehicle, it also really, you know, sheds a spotlight on the fact that the federal government maintains that this is a Schedule I substance, because Schedule I defines, amongst other things, that it has no accepted medical use. Well, here is a government-funded agency, the National Academy, saying this has undeniable medical use. So there is no way that the cannabis belongs in Schedule I, never did, but here we now finally have the government talking to itself saying, you know, grow up. So that's where we are.
So, doctor, what I would like to do, we're speaking with Dr. Jordan Tischler, and he was just found out a really fascinating and an important piece of information about this study. After we go off the air, I'll want to get the address or where we can get that over the internet, and we'll put it on the website so people can go and read it. Because I was unaware until you mentioned it that study was there, and thank you so much for doing that. Did you want to say something else?
I was just going to warn you that it's a 400-page document, but there is a 4-page summary at the beginning of it, so that shouldn't frighten off your listeners.
Good, thank you. I appreciate that. I wanted to move to your practice because you make some pretty significant statements about nobody's ever died from cannabis overdose, and not that cannot be said for opioids and even alcohol. But when I first got involved in this, I had a false impression. My impression was that this was basically, quote, as you said, stoners. But as I started talking to dispensary operators and owners and doctors, it's the opposite. The average age of the purchaser, which they thought was going to be 21 to 35, the average age of the purchaser of cannabis is 56 years of age in this country. And why would a person, I assume you must have some patients that you're treating with cannabis that may be older. Do you know why they do it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, an interesting question would be, what's the average age in my practice? And that's well above 55. Most of my patients are in the 70-plus range. I've had at least one who is over 100, a few in that sort of higher 99 range. And the reason is very clear, which is to say that pain is an unfortunate consequence of aging. And so essentially we can all say that, you know, if we live long enough, God willing, then we're going to get to a point where pain figures prominently in our lives. And so that's the number one reason that people come to visit me. And as you point out, it tends to be an older demographic. I have a bunch of people in the sort of middle age demographic, and unfortunately, these are generally the people who have gotten cancer, and so they have a very, strong need for relief, both from the cancer if it's causing pain or anxiety, and also, unfortunately, from the treatments that we have for the cancer, which do often work, but they come with side effects, you know, like nausea and vomiting and weight loss and those sorts of things. So, you know, there's really a remarkable need in both of these groups. We're really absolutely not talking about 20-year-olds, getting stoned. And at least in my practice, I very carefully select, you know, who comes in, because I'm not particularly interested in the 21-year-old stoners. And now in Massachusetts, they can just go to the store and buy, you know, recreational weed. But really the point is to get care to the people who need it.
We have about 2 minutes left and a couple more questions that I'd like to throw out at you. What I'm hearing from the dispensaries, medical dispensaries, is that the older person not interested in smoking, they're interested in the edibles or infusions. Is that true in your practice too?
Well, I think that there's a little bit of marketing involved in that. That's a way of saying to older people, you know, if you don't want this, we have a substitute. I think that in reality, from a medical point of view, it's not quite a simple substitution. Inhalation behaves in a certain way, and things taken orally behave in a very different way. And actually, in my practice, the recommendation that I give depends upon what we're treating. So I never recommend that anyone actually literally smoke this stuff, but there are ways that we can use a vaporizer, which is a special tool that allows us to inhale the medicine without any of the smoke. And everybody's probably thinking vaporizers look like these little pen things. Those are not things I recommend either. Those things tend to burn that oil, and then you're exposing yourself to a different kind of smoke. But in fact, what I'm talking about are small handheld devices that you actually put ground up botanical material in, weed, that are more sophisticated. They have a little computer in them, and they can do the job we need. But that is a very effective way of approaching a certain set of problems that need a rapid solution, like a migraine headache or nausea and vomiting, that sort of thing. The edibles are better for things that need a long duration, like, you know, chronic pain, because they're slow to work, but once they work for a much longer period of time.
Doctor, we're just about out of time. How can people reach you? How do they hear about your wonderful practice and your thoughts and philosophy about cannabis?
The best thing to do would be to go to my website, which is inhalemd.com. Again, inhalemd.com. On the website, I've got a whole bunch of videos. You can contact me through the website. And we do, online or telephonic consultation. So you don't need to be anywhere near Massachusetts for us to be able to help you.
That's amazing. We've been talking to Dr. Jordan Tischler, fascinating and dedicated physician in trying to heal people what he's supposed to do. And we'll have your website on our website so people can reach you. And Dr. Jordan, thank you so much for joining us today on America's Cannabis Conversation.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Let's listen as Dan introduces us to his next guest.
We're dealing with our segment of people who have had great success using cannabis, and we have a really, really special guest that I happen to have met in person, former veteran like myself, Jeffrey DeMond. We had a chance to spend a little time talking about some of the injuries that he received and what happened to him relative to opioid and what he did to get off of the opioids and how cannabis helped, and then what he's done to try and help other veterans. So, Jeffrey, welcome to the conversation. Tell us a little bit about your story.
Thank you. Thank you, Dan. I appreciate it. I don't find myself remarkable at all. I did my time in the Navy and did whatever it was that they asked me to do. Unfortunately, I was injured. And I really don't even blame the surgeons or the doctors that treated me. But I was overprescribed opioids for a period of at least 9 years where the maximum time I was taking 120 milligrams of morphine and 80 milligrams of Oxycontin, 6 milligrams of Klonopin, and a laundry list of other medications that would fill a grocery sack.
I'm sorry, I have to stop here, Jeffrey, because it's just amazing what you're talking about, all the drugs. Tell them, if you would, about one of the reasons why you had to have the drugs of all the various kinds of surgeries that you've had.
Yeah, so I had four ankle reconstructions. I had herniated a disc in my neck, a herniated disc in my back. I've had my right shoulder replaced before I turned 40. I've torn my right bicep. I've had my left wrist reconstructed. I've been stuck between my fingers with a knife. There's just been a whole laundry list of things that had happened to me. I've banged my head and been in accidents a number of times in the military as well. So, around 2001 is when I had my first surgery, where they had given me some Tylox, was my first introduction, I guess, to some sort of opioid. And then I just had, beat my body up so much in the military that when I went in to talk about this, they would either put me in rehab. And in rehab is where I found that I had multiple issues with my ankles and things like that. But their solution was to stop the pain. That it was a Band-Aid. It wasn't to fix me. It was to help me deal with it. And I don't even know if they really thought about what they were doing until, people have a completely different view on opioids as they do marijuana now, I hope. I tell people that the Navy was my entrance drug to opioids and marijuana was my exit drug. Quite the opposite of what the stigma is, Really in a lot of pain. And beyond that, I was traumatized too. I was a young man who was addicted, who had been at the very top of my game in the military. And now my head was in the wrong place. I was in therapy and I was over-medicated, and that's a mixture for really bad results.
What happened that you decided I've got to get off these opioids?
It's almost comical. I come from a big family. My mom is the oldest of, 12 brothers and sisters, and my aunt is only 7 years older than me. I was born in 66, but I'm really a product of the 60s because I was a tag-along baby to this hippie family. And when I went away in the Navy, I was kind of trying to get away from that scene and trying to do something else. I knew about addiction. I knew about people with alcohol problems. I knew about that kind of stuff, and I was trying to do something different with my life. That's why it kind of hurt me so bad when I ended up falling prey to the opioids and becoming an addict myself. Because I was always so aware of that. I was never that drunk sailor in another port. I was always that one guy that was going to take a tour and get back to the boat. I might have a few drinks. I'm not anti-drinking. I'm not anti-whatever. But for me, I knew about addiction. And so when I got back from the Navy, and here I am addicted to opioids and not really seeing it that way, one of my young cousins of 50, 50 cousins on that side, he came home from college and he's like, "Wow, man, you got a problem." And I said, "What do you mean?" He goes, you're hooked to those pills, man. There's other ways out there." And I said, "I'm not hooked." He said, "Well, when's your prescription due?" And I just blurted out, "Thursday." And he's like, "Seriously, you know, Thursday already? It's, you know, so you're telling me?" And he just kind of said, "You know, I'm seeing you do the opioid nod right here in front of me as we're talking. You're nodding off. You got issues, and I'm just trying to help you. There's other medicines out there like cannabis." Well, 20 years in the Navy was, you know, that was a no-no for me. That was abstinence. You zero tolerance if you got caught with cannabis in your system. You were out of the military. So I really hadn't even considered that as medicine. And he, you know, referenced a couple things that he knew and encouraged me to do a little bit of research and try it. And I did. And in 2 months' time, I was able to half my dose of opioids. Of that, I think that was, you know, me willing it too, because I was very conscious of what I was trying to do and what I was trying to do with that medicine. So every time it was time for me to take my pills, which is a very solitary thing, you know what I mean? Oh, I got to go home and take my pills. It makes me sick to even think about it now. I would push that time frame to the right, and I would use cannabis in place and try and get that same level of relief out of cannabis. And I was in a completely illegal state, smoking completely illegal whole flower. I had no access to a medical system whatsoever.
When you started using it, and you said in relatively short period of time you'd cut your opioid in half, was the cannabis helping with the pain?
Yes. And at that point, I really didn't know any of the science or anything about the endocannabinoid system, or, you know, how it didn't affect the bottom of my brain stem, so it wouldn't affect my breathing like opioids and benzodiazepines do. So I didn't even understand that then. And what I would tell my doctor was, I don't really care if it's really working and making my pain go away and helping my body, or if it's just tricking my head into making me think that my pain's going away and it's helping my body. Either way, I'm taking less opioids, so let's keep doing it. You know what I mean?
How long did it take you to get totally off?
2 years.
Wow.
Yeah, 2 years. Yeah, and I think a lot of that was crutch time. You know what I mean? I was just afraid. I didn't want to be sick, and I didn't want to. And I really, once I quit the opioids, that wasn't really the end of my pain. You know, I still have pain. Once I started on a cannabis regime, from a medical, cannabis using oils and vaporizers for breakthrough, I still like the whole flower. I find it very calming to break down marijuana. It's like a therapy treatment for me. I get excited. I can smell it. I can see it. I can feel it in my fingers. It's, very therapeutic. It's like, releasing endorphins before you're running a race or something, you know. It makes anticipating that medicine. And I talk about that when I lecture people too, because I don't want people to be afraid of smoking. You know, and that's the time that I use for myself to kind of calm my day down, is to break that apart and fill up a cone or something to, take some medicine later. And that really, really helps me relieve myself. But speaking about the medical, the oils and tinctures, I was able to quit my Lyrica, and I was on heavy doses of Lyrica for neuropathic pain. It felt like my feet would burn like I was standing on hot asphalt. And once I started on 12-to-1 tincture oil from Sutera, it's 12-to-1 CBD to THC. I do that at night and in the morning. That that neuropathic pain has completely gone away. There, I mean, maybe one day in 30 do I feel any burning in my feet.
That's absolutely amazing.
It's amazing. Right. You know, and sometimes when I lecture or when I talk to crowds of veterans or whatever, it seems like I'm telling fables, or, you know, I got a cart full of snake oil out there. But if you think about it, before 1937, before they outlawed it, they really did have oils and stuff that they passed around that had indica and sativa, you know, oils in it. So it is medicine, and it is a snake oil of sorts, because, you know, it was a holistic healer that used them, and not, you know, necessarily doctor prescribed.
We're talking to Jeffrey DeMond, who is a veteran who was in a lot of pain because of his service in the Navy, and was on opioids and got off.
And we'll be right back.
America's Cannabis Conversation.
Welcome back to the conversation. This is Dan Perkins.
I think that the next part of the discussion, Jeffrey, is how you paid it forward, how you took what you did and created a foundation to help other veterans.
Let me say first that I didn't learn all this stuff on my own. There are really smart people in the medical marijuana field, and I think that that's why there needs to be some semblance of doctor. You know, kind of how it is now in Florida, where you have to see a doctor and they give you a, because no one should try to do what I did on their own. It's very dangerous to stop certain medications, and I feel that it's my job to say that, because it is encouraging to hear great stories like this, but every person's individual, and I would hate for someone to stop. And, you know, I learned so much from Dr. Son at Iona Cannabis Clinic. For his knowledge of marijuana far outweighed mine, and I quit all of those opioids. I mean, he knows the science behind it. So I would just still recommend people see a doctor. Okay, from there, and having been involved with Dr. Son, he afforded me some opportunities to do events, and those events turned into some opportunity for me to speak at Collier County, which was having a difficult time getting a dispensary. I thought to myself, I'm going to go to a veterans organization and see if they'll help me and come out and listen to me speak about marijuana. I went to one of their meetings, and there was a young lady in there. I walked in wearing a cannabis shirt, and apparently some other medical marijuana doctor had been down there previous and said that they were going to give away 5 certifications to these vets that were in need, or whatever, something I had no idea of what was really going on. But they approached me with this, and I said, whoa, I'm not that guy, but I may be able to do something for someone if I, you know. And so they introduced me to this young lady. Her name's Cece Conway, and she's a Marine, and she's one of the strongest women I've ever met. She's got a 7-year-old daughter. She suffers from PTSD from the Marine Corps. She had to have a knee replacement. They botched her surgery. She has to have, she's got some issues in her leg that she's going to have multiple surgeries. She didn't want to be on opioids. I approached my doctor, Dr. Son, kind of talked to him about, you know, me doing events and this, that, and paying it forward. He decided that he would see her for free. For me, that wasn't good enough. I feel like the state of Florida gives a lot to the veterans already, but I think that $75 state fee should be waived for all Sons of Florida veterans. So I started a foundation where I pay that $75 for veterans to get their card so that they can, you know, have that money to get started on medicine. Because one of the best benefits is for cannabis as medicine is that you don't have to have a long time. You can change your medicine in 2 weeks and see results in two weeks. You don't have to titrate up on some medicine to have it in your body and then titrate off of it because it's bad to stop it at one time. So you can take a medicine like a sativa oil and see if that's the right one for you and not use it again and try another oil and see if that one helps the symptoms that you're. So there's, you know, like I said, everyone's different when they use their medical cannabis, and so it takes a little bit of trial and error, and that's another service that I provide. I answer phone calls from these from veterans from Korean War, Vietnam War to Afghanistan, you know, just to want to talk about the medicine and how they're doing it, if they're doing it right, and, you know, talk about things like microdosing throughout the day so that you're not totally high all day long. You can microdose and have enough medicine in your body that will carry you through throughout the day until you need to go home and take more medicine. So, you know, there's a lot of things that are involved in being well and using cannabis to make you well. And I don't think that veterans are being taught that. The VA has now said that if you're a veteran in a cannabis, medical cannabis state, that they can't stop your benefits, they can't stop your treatment. You can still receive your full pay and go to school and do everything that any other veteran would do. So they're doing that for states that are medical cannabis states. But there are veterans in states that are retiring or getting out of the military and their home destination is a medical cannabis state, but they're not necessarily in a medical cannabis state when they leave. So these vets have no idea what the VA rules are, no idea what's available to them. And I think that's a disservice because we're sending them home with a grocery sack full of medicine when there's a much better alternative to that. And it frustrates me that, you know, the VA says it's okay only in states that allow it, but the VA is government funded and right. You know, from the federal government funded, but they're agreeing with the states that have allowed medical abuse.
Jeffrey, we're just about out of time. Let me thank you for your service. Thank you for appearing on the show today. How can people get a hold of you? Do you have a website for your foundation?
It's www.thegratefulveteran.com, or they could reach me at that same thegratefulveteran@gmail.com, and I'll get back to them. You know, I got T-shirts and photo prints of all kinds of military and cannabis-related information about to drop. So I really appreciate you having me on your show, and I would be willing to do anything for you in the future.
Thank you so much for joining us today. We've been speaking with Jeffrey DeMond. Thank you.
Hundreds of thousands of people who work in the cannabis industry trying to help people are not permitted to tell their story on the public airways of radio and TV. In spite of these restrictions, the American cannabis industry is growing at about 35% per year and accelerating. As you listen to this show, you will hear real people telling their story of how cannabis helped them or business people who grew their business. When I started talking to people in the exploding cannabis business and telling them what we were trying to do, I heard this common question. When can you help me? Well, starting today, we are going to give you a voice. We promise to do our best to bring you a high-value, entertaining program. Come back for more.
Now let's continue the conversation with Dan and his guest.
Good afternoon and welcome to the conversation. And joining us today is a regular contributor, Morgan Fox, from the National Cannabis Industry Association. And he's here to talk to us about several things. Good afternoon, Morgan, and welcome to the conversation again.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
You're welcome, sir. A lot to talk about. We had a Michigan court this week overturn a ruling by the state of Michigan on suspending the sale of vape product. We had another directive from the Center for Disease Control that while they're not quite sure what is it in the elements that go into a vape pen are causing the sickness or death, but they are telling us that they believe that it's probably going to be illegal product that's being sold. So as a communications director and working with the lobbyists for your organization in Washington, how does your organization come to grips with how do we fix this problem?
Well, I think that it's really important that the CDC is pointing out what the evidence is showing, which is that the vast majority of these cases are related to illicit market products. And, you know, simple blanket bans on regulated products won't do anything to fix that problem. In fact, it may even exacerbate it by driving people to the illicit market, as well as incentivizing people that are currently illicit market producers to ramp up production and cut more corners, making these products even more dangerous. And, you know, it looks like the CDC is getting the message here, and it's what we are making sure to tell lawmakers and regulators whenever we're speaking to them about this issue, because it's really important. You know, prohibition clearly doesn't work, and we need a more thoughtful approach to this issue to try to displace the illicit market if we really want to deal with this issue. And I think that what we're seeing at the state level is really kind of taking this into account, too. Only Massachusetts so far has implemented any sort of total vaping bans. All of the other states that have attempted to, Michigan before the ban was overturned, Washington and Oregon, are only explicitly banning flavored vapes, which we found actually does not apply to the vast majority of regulated cannabis vaporizer products, because most of them use flavorings that are naturally occurring within the cannabis plant themselves in the form of terpenes.
Well, you know, I've been following this, and I've written about this in some of the commentaries that I write, and they're just something that doesn't make any sense to me, so maybe you can straighten me out. The guy in Michigan who filed the suit said, hey, look, this has helped me get off of cigarettes, which is a good thing. And I hear that time and time again. And so it seems as if the government, or governments plural, is looking to curb behavior that the vast majority of law-abiding citizens are not doing. And I think your point is so well taken. They don't seem to be understanding the fact that if you put controls on this, it's going to drive people to the black market, and who knows how many people could die. So I don't understand why they just don't understand the logic of your argument.
Well, I think that it's important to note that bans are not control. Regulation is control. And that's exactly what we want. We want to be able to have systems in place that control what goes into these vaporizer cartridges as well as what comes out of them. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of testing there either. When it comes to the safety of vaping over smoking, I think that you know, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that that's the case. And there are a number of patients in medical marijuana states that really depend on the use of vaporizers because they can't smoke or they can't use edibles for whatever medical reason. And so, you know, implementing bans like this are really going to hurt patients that have very specific needs the most.
I hear what you're saying, and I agree with what you're saying. It's just, maybe I'm too logical, Morgan. It just seems to me that no matter what legislations you pass, you can't change the behavior under bans. And it seems to me if that they're taking the wrong approach. Now, I'm not suggesting that you're supporting what I'm about to say, but I'm just throwing it out there. One way to change the behavior of illegal activity is make it very expensive to bill illegal. And so I think they ought to start imposing fines for possession of $100,000 per ounce. And that's going to make – see, without a distribution point, without a way for the consumer to buy it, the illegal manufacturers are dead in the water. So if you attack the distribution by making fines, if you're caught with illegal, it's going to cost you $100,000 an ounce, may have a much bigger impact on the control of the dangerous part of this business, that is the illegal activity.
Well, I can't agree with punishing cannabis consumers with extremely stringent fines simply because they obtain their products on the illicit market. I think that if we really want to deal with this issue, it's not a matter of making it incredibly expensive for consumers. What we need to do is make sure that regulated products are cheaper than the ones obtained on the illicit market, or at the very least competitively priced. That way, there's no incentive for people to purchase them on the illicit market. And the only way to do that is to deschedule cannabis at the federal level, regulate it, and get rid of some of the onerous financial burdens that are placed on producers, such as lack of access to banking, overtaxation at the federal level, extremely high licensing costs at the state level, and things like that, which make operating these businesses so much more expensive than operating an illegal underground vape factory.
Well, I understand what you're saying. I guess I wonder if we take it under control, how that control, if you talk about all the things you want to do, leads me to one question, and we've got about a minute left in this segment, and we'll be right back. I want you to think about this before we take our quick break. How would the states feel about supporting cannabis if, under what you're suggesting, there was a significant decline in the tax revenue that the states might earn? And with that, we've been talking with Morgan Fox from the National Cannabis Industry Association, and we'll be right back to get Morgan's answer to that question.
America's Cannabis Conversation.
So we're back on the conversation with Morgan Fox of the National Cannabis Industry Association. And I asked him a tough question, at least I thought it was a tough question. How would the states feel about significantly reducing their taxation on the product in order to make the product more competitive with illegal? And Morgan, you say?
Well, I think that initially we would see a drop in tax revenue. But as the illegal and regulated market further displaces the illicit market, we're going to start seeing tax revenue grow again because there are more taxable sales happening. This is something that might not happen right away, but I think that over time we would end up with significantly more tax revenue when we wipe out the illicit untaxed market.
It's a good point. Very good point. Morgan, by the way, tell people how they can get in touch with you.
The National Cannabis Industry Association can be found at thecannabisindustry.org. We're also available on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
Thank you for that. I appreciate it. Do you think that all of the publicity about the people who've been sick and the people who have died and the correlation where it seems that most of these incidents are dealing with illicit product, do you think it's beginning to have an impact on what people think about where they're buying and what they're buying?
Oh, absolutely. Obviously, we've seen both legal and illegal sales, at least as far as the evidence that I've seen, dropping in the wake of this public health crisis. But I think that it really is making people think a little bit harder about where their products are sourced from and start to really think about the benefits of regulation over an entirely unregulated criminal system.
Do you think if what you're proposing were to be enacted by Congress, all the things that you talk about you want to have happen, how quickly can it be implemented?
I think that's difficult to say. It would require a bill actually getting passed that would comprehensively deschedule cannabis and establish regulatory structures such as what NCIA has proposed in terms of giving regulatory control over cannabis to the FDA and the Alcohol and Tobacco Tax and Trade Bureau. Getting that bill actually passed doesn't look like something that is going to happen in this Congress, but it's a possibility for maybe next year. Once that happens, then the FDA and the TTB would have to actually sit down with stakeholders and experts and determine exactly what the regulatory policies should be in terms of what sort of things are allowed in these products, exactly how they should be tested, what sort of guidance they should be giving to the states. So this is a kind of a long process, but it's difficult to say exactly how long. Certainly, there's a lot of motivation to address this issue, so hopefully that would start greasing the wheels of both Congress as well as these federal agencies a bit.
As a person intimately involved in lobbying in Washington, D.C., do you think that the congressmen and senators are paying attention to this issue of people getting sick and dying on illegal product?
Absolutely. I think it's really just a matter of making sure that they fully understand the issue. And, there are definitely prohibitionist groups out there that are trying to falsely paint this issue as being a direct cause of legalization, when in reality, the cause is prohibition.
Okay, I agree. I also wondered if you happened to see any of the Democratic debate on Tuesday night, when we had some people advocating for the decriminalization of heroin and cocaine.
Well, I think that the paradigm is really starting to shift on the issue of drugs and prohibition in this country. And, we don't take any stance on any other drugs, but I think that it's important to note that people are starting to realize that drug use is a public health issue and not a criminal justice issue.
Yeah, and one of the candidates were talking about, quote, the decriminalization of opioids. And I never knew that they were criminalized. I never knew where they were an illegal substance. These companies submit their new drug applications and they go through the testing process and they get approval. But somebody was talking about decriminalization of opioids. So I agree with you. I think there's a hopefully a broadening discussion of what we're doing about drugs.
When they're talking about decriminalization of opioids, they're talking about heroin. Other prescription opioids are definitely on the Controlled Substances Act schedule of substances, but they are legal in some form or have a legal structure for them.
Yes, but we also know that there's drugs coming in over the southern border that are opioids that are killing a lot of people. So it's almost as if this is not just an American issue. It's an issue that involves a lot of Americans, but a lot of people around the world. So we can address it, but what about the rest of the world? Is there interest? Are you hearing anything about people in dealing with cannabis or marijuana? I read conflicting stories all the time about this country's changed their mind. They're going to make it legal, and others are saying they're not going to make it legal. What's happening globally in your product area?
Well, I think that we're definitely seeing an increasing number of countries move towards sensible cannabis laws, at the very least medical programs. A number of EU countries have instituted a very robust medical cannabis program. A bunch of countries in Latin America are considering legalization. Mexico is slated to make cannabis legal for adults within the month. And, we're just starting to see a lot more of an international consensus on this issue. Unfortunately, there are some groups at the UN that don't feel that way, largely because the head of the UN Drug Control Commission is chaired by Russia, which have very draconian drug policies.
One of the things that I've been watching and following, and we've got about a minute left here, is the tremendous expansion of research that's taken place at colleges and universities on cannabis for many, many different things that has been a long time coming. And I think the prohibitive nature of our federal rules scared a lot of people into doing it and not doing it. And now they feel more comfortable about taking the risk.
Well, there are still tremendous barriers to research because of federal prohibition. So, while we're seeing an outgrowth of additional research, it's very difficult to be able to actually source research material. And it's only a sliver of what could be taking place if we were to end prohibition and remove those barriers.
You're raising a really important point. We've got an interview coming up with a Harvard doctor researcher who's studying the impact of cannabis on pancreatic cancer and other cancers in the body. And he told me that he had to get the DEA, Drug Enforcement Agency, in order to get the product that he needed to do his test. They had to physically go to Canada and get it and bring it to him so he could run the test. So I guess you're right. There's a lot of work that has to be done. We've been speaking with Morgan Fox, the Communications Director of the National Cannabis Industry Association. And before we leave you, tell us where we can get in touch with you.
TheCannabisIndustry.org. And thanks again for having me.
Thank you, sir. It's a pleasure. Didn't hear all of this interview? You can go to our website, W420Radio.network, and you can hear the interview with Morgan and some of the other shows that he's been on. And thank you for joining the conversation today. This is Dan Perkins.
Let's listen as Dan introduces us to his next guest.
Welcome to the conversation. This is Dan Perkins, and joining us today is Anthony Plantis from Mendon Hill Publishing, and he's our expert on investing in cannabis. Thank you for joining us today, Anthony.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
Thank you. We talked earlier before we went on the air about a couple of things we wanted to talk about, and so let's start off with the first one. That is, it's been about 12 months since the total deregulation of cannabis sales in Canada. And many, many corporations are reporting earnings, and they've been very disappointing. Were you surprised?
No, I'm not too surprised. Canada has taken a very measured and what many consider a slow approach to rolling out legalized cannabis, but that's to be expected. They're the first major nation to legalize cannabis on the recreational level. And so all eyes are on them, and so they're trying to make sure that they do it right, and part of doing it right means taking their time.
Do you think they've grown too fast? Are the regulators impacting, or is the market not as big as they thought it was going to be for recreational and medical cannabis in Canada? What do you think caused the disappointment?
I think the market kind of just got too far ahead of themselves with a lot of this stuff. You know, Canada has been pretty firm on setting expectations as far as things were going to take a little bit of time for them to roll out. Ontario is one of the probably the most disappointing. They started with such few dispensaries. They took 6 months before they allowed any dispensaries at all. And Ontario is home to nearly half of the Canadian populace. And so I think that was kind of the most disappointing aspect. The rest of the nation has been pretty much on pace with what I would expect. But, I mean, it is going to take some time to introduce legalized cannabis and to get people to move away from the black market product and into the illegal supply.
Is the black market a big problem in Canada? Is there a big, an active black market there?
Yeah, there still is. So part of the problem with the black market is that they can undercut the legal prices. Of course, there are safety concerns because these products aren't tested. So the reason that they can undercut prices is they don't have to pay taxes. They don't have to do any kind of special testing. They can use whatever chemicals they want to produce growth rates and all that stuff. And ultimately, all that is a detriment to people's health and safety. It can be contaminated by mold and chemicals and all sorts of things that just people aren't aware of. And so part of it is educating the population on the dangers of the black market and the benefits of the legal product.
Well, I think that's a very important point. And we're speaking with Anthony Planis from Beacon Hill. And how do people get in touch with you again real quick, Anthony?
Just go to banyanhill.com and you can find all of our editorial content there.
And we'll find you there?
Yep.
Okay, good. Now, let's just take what you were talking about and transition into the second thing we want to talk about, and that is the vape controversy. CDC is basically saying now that they believe that most of the problems are the result of black market canisters that were built in an unregulated market and have no idea what was in the canisters. And so that's, you think that's going to be a lesson to the consumer, or is it because it's, and I'm not diminishing the loss of life, it's such a small number of people considered the number of people who are using it. Will it have an impact on the consumer thinking about buying black market product?
Yeah, absolutely. So right now we've seen fears over vaping products affect even the legal market with sales dropping temporarily, and then now that we know the black market sales are kind of plateaued, and so yeah, you know, what happens is people realize that there's a threat, and they realize that that threat is from the black market supply, and you know, health and safety is everyone's number one concern. So what ends up happening is that pushes people away from the black market and to the legal and regulated supplies because they know they have peace of mind there. We actually saw the same kind of thing as far as Prohibition era alcohol, where after Prohibition ended, there were still moonshine and bootleg liquor being sold, but again, it's not being regulated. The producers of this on the illegal market aren't careful, so it can have toxins, it's impure, and it can cause serious health effects. And so the same kind of thing where, you know, the black market is going to persist for a time, but ultimately, it will lose because even if it has better prices, safety and health is something that you can't put the price on.
Yeah, and I think that the fact that it's an unfortunate thing to say this, that we had to have some people get very sick and die with the black market product. But you know, we had a situation earlier this week. You may be aware of that. A Michigan court overturned the restriction of the Cannabis Authority about stopping the sale of vaping product because they believed that the physical health issues for people who were suffering from tobacco addiction, that the vaping system was a medical way for them to relieve themselves of that crutch, and it was actually saving lives. So the idea of stopping it They were saying the number of people affected minimizes the importance of making the product available. So I thought that was a signal. It may be appealed, but it's still a significant situation when the court jumps in and says, wait a minute, don't act irrationally here. There are people who have been helped by this vaping technology, and it's a good technology. So now we have a situation where we're coming up on the end of the third quarter and in the United States. Later this month or early November, we should be beginning to see some earnings from domestic operations. Are you getting any inklings there?
I think domestic sales are going to be a little bit lower on the vaping side of things just because of everything that's gone on. So some of that is going to get baked into these quarterly reports. But overall, you know, most of the multi-state operators have really been driving strong sales, stronger than Canada. Part of that is just because state by state, there usually isn't the same kind of regulatory burden that Canada has put on its own consumers. So I think almost definitely we're going to see some hampering of vaping sales, but overall, I expect sales to be growing, at least for dried cannabis, at the very least.
I saw something today, Anthony, that just blew me away. I saw a Google report of two dispensary operators in Florida that are now for sale in the Miami area. And for our listeners, a dispensary license isn't just one building. You could have as many as, in one case, 22 or 23 branches, and the other one was like 28 or 31 branches. One was being offered, I just can't believe this number, one was being offered at $50 million, and the other one was being offered at $45 million. Two dispensaries in Miami for medical only, $95 million.
Yeah, that's a pretty significant amount of money, but I'm not overly surprised considering the Miami market.
It's a big market. Yeah, Florida is one of the fastest growing, and it's only medical. And there was a recent lawsuit brought that, and I think the court said so, they're going to expand 25 more licenses to bring more dispensaries, physical storefronts to the people of Florida. So it's already growing by leaps and bounds, one of the fastest in the country. So 25 more licenses could certainly add to it. So I just thought it was $95 million for two dispensaries. I just thought it was just amazing. And are you hearing anything about prices going up for dispensaries in other parts of the country?
I look at it more of when these companies are acquiring or selling dispensaries, how much they're selling them for. It's location by location, you know. So Miami is going to be a very different market than Central or North Florida.
Terrific. We've been speaking with Anthony, our money guy. Thank you for joining us today. And one more time, tell the people how they can get a hold of you. And we'll have you on our website, too. So how do they get a hold of you, Anthony?
Yeah, banyanhill.com, and you can find all of our editorial content there.
Super. We've been speaking with Anthony Planis from Banyan Hill Publishing, who is our regular money guy. And if you missed part of this show or you missed any of the show today, you can go to our website, W420RadioNetwork.com, and download previous shows and look for a posting on Anthony, how to get in contact with him. Thank you for joining us today on America's Cannabis Conversation.
America's Cannabis Conversation.
Thank you for joining the conversation today, and we hope that you will join us in the coming weeks. Here are just a few of the guests joining the conversation. A Harvard researcher studying the impact of cannabis on pancreatic cancer, and he's getting ready to start an FDA study. An entrepreneur who his whole family started a CBD products manufacturing and distribution company. A power engineer who helps potential growers figure out how much power they will need to run their grow houses. You will be surprised at how much power is really needed. A man who designed and built trimming machines for cannabis, and he eliminates hand trimmers and pays for itself in months, not years. An investment analyst will help you make sense out of investing in cannabis stocks. A British pharmacist who has a 12-point checklist that for you to go over before you buy CBD products. So go to our website, www.americascannabisconversation.com, and you can see who's coming on next week and in future weeks. Keep coming back, finding more information. These and many more interesting conversations are coming up on America's Cannabis Conversation for you. This is Dan Perkins. Come join us next week.
America's Cannabis Conversation.